Good evening, everyone. This is Josh Taylor with Congressman Chet Edwards' office, and I would like to welcome you to tonight's live telephone town hall on healthcare, and we thank you very much for joining us. Before I introduce Chet, let me go over just a few specifics. First, everyone needs to know that they can press *3 on their phone at any time during the call, and that will put you in line to ask the congressman a question. After you press *3 on your phone, what will happen is you'll be transferred to one of our operators, and they will take down your question and then put you in line to ask a live question while you're listening to the discussion. The call tonight's going to go until 8 p.m., so we'll be taking questions that come from the northern, central, and southern parts of our 12-county district. And obviously, with thousands of people participating, we would respectfully ask that you limit your questions or your comments to 1 minute or less, so that we can get as many people as possible to ask their questions. Now, obviously, in the time we have allotted, time is going to prevent Chet from answering every single question live, but what will happen is you'll be able to leave Chet a message at the end of the call, and then we'll do our very best to get you a timely response. So again, just remember that you want to press *3 on your phone, and that will put you in line to ask a question. And after the call is concluded tonight, we will post the entire discussion on our website at edwards.house.gov, and that'll be up there tomorrow by about 5 p.m. So with that, I'm pleased to introduce Congressman Edwards for some opening remarks.
Well, good evening. This is Chet Edwards, and I want to thank each of you for joining with citizens from throughout the 17th District to participate in our telephone town hall meeting on health care. Our goal tonight is to allow an open dialogue on the important issue of health care reform, and I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Since it will take a number of minutes to complete the phone calls to all 12 counties, I will wait until 7 p.m. to outline some of my observations about the health care process in Congress and to summarize the major provisions of the House bill. So if we've been able to set up the first phone call, let's begin with the first question.
Looks like we have one question from the Waco area. Actually, Chet, they're still being screened, so we've got a few more calls coming in. We don't have a live question just yet.
Okay, well then let me just reiterate that we're very, very glad to have all of you participate in our town hall meeting. And I'd like to repeat what Josh said in his opening comments, that if once we get going and have made most of the calls throughout the district, if you're not able to have your question asked or your comments heard live in this discussion, then please stay on at the end of the program at 8 p.m. You'll be able to stay on the line. You will hear a message voice tone, and then at the sound of that tone, you can leave a message, and our office will then work very diligently in the days ahead to see that we try to answer each of the questions expressed by people throughout our district. But it's great to have everybody on, and we want to begin with questions and comments as soon as possible. Josh, do we have any questions?
I think we have one that's about to come open. I just want to remind everybody to press *3 on their phone if they want to ask a question, and then that will take them to one of our operators who will then put you in the line to ask a live question of the congressman. Let me see if I can get one right here. George Collins from McGregor.
Yes.
George, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome
Hi,
to the
George.
Call.
George, this is Chet Edwards. Thanks for calling in, and we'd like to have you make the first comments or ask the first question.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be on. As I understand it, Mr. Edwards, right now there are five different health plans being kicked around, like three in the House and two in the Senate. And so my question is, how can any of us at this point in time know what's going to be in the bill, and when will the American people know what's in the bill, and will we have a chance to say something at that point in time before it's voted on?
George, the fact is you're right. There is in the House actually one bill that has come out of three different committees, and while there are other bills being kicked around. The basic bill that the House will vote on probably in September or maybe October, that is one bill, and it's a 1,000-page bill. It's a long, complicated bill. And frankly, I share the frustrations probably of you and many people throughout our district who are trying to make a good faith effort to figure out what is in and not in these bills. And I'm not going to make up my mind on how to vote on the final legislation until I actually know what it is, have had a chance to review it from front cover to back cover, and have had a chance to listen to people from all throughout our district and hear their views on it. In the Senate, none of the Senate committees have actually passed out of committee a Senate bill. So, frankly, it's hard to know at all what the Senate will come up with. Where I do want to compliment the Senate is they are still trying to work diligently on a bipartisan basis to come up with a bill that both Republicans and Democrats could support. I don't know if they'll be successful in that effort, but if they are, I certainly think it would be better for the country and maximize the chances of a successful health care reform bill if we had, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and independents working together on this legislation.
Well, thank you very much, sir. That sounds real good. Appreciate your efforts.
Well, George, thank you, and thanks for calling in. And also, at about 7 o'clock, I'm going to give an overall view of some of the key 5 provisions in the House bill. So if you can stay on that long, then at that point, I'll try to get into some of the specifics of the major provisions of the House bill. Thank you, George.
Thanks very much. I look forward to that.
Thank you.
Chet, we have a call from Patricia in Brazos County who has a question about VA health care. Patricia, are you with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hi, Patricia. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. And first, Mr. Edwards, I want to say that I admire you so much for helping our veterans, and I am a big supporter of yours, as I guess you may know. But my question, first of all, was I wonder how this will affect our Medicare because I'm an elderly person.
Patricia, first, thanks for your kind comments about my work on behalf of veterans. It's been the professional privilege of my lifetime to try to give just a little bit back to those who've given so very much to our country. And this past Sunday, my two young sons and wife and I were down at Fort Hood thanking families who've given the ultimate sacrifice. They had lost their dads or their husbands in combat service to our country in Iraq. And I am always humbled and inspired when I'm around our veterans and those who've served our country. And as you know, as we talk about this health care debate, I care deeply about improving and protecting the quality of health care for our veterans. I appreciate your asking about what this bill will do in terms of services to senior citizens. First, let me tell you what it will not do. I am really deeply disappointed that some, in an effort to push whatever their personal agenda is, have tried to terrorize senior citizens by saying that there are death panels in this bill that would create a program for euthanasia for senior citizens. You know, if people will stop just for a minute and think about that, it absolutely defies common sense. And I can promise you with 100% certainty, there is nothing in this bill, and there will not be in any bill, that passes the House that or the Senate that would set up any kind of panels to encourage ways to cut off services to senior citizens, health care services, or to set up some sort of death panels. And frankly, I'm disappointed that anyone would stoop so low as to try to spread that kind of rumor around. On the plus side for senior citizens, and one of the reasons AARP has made a lot of positive comments about this bill, many of our seniors are facing very high prescription drug costs, Patricia, and this bill will, in the short run, reduce the out-of-pocket health care drug cost for seniors that are in the donut hole of the Medicare Part D program by 50%. And then over a number of years, it will actually eliminate out-of-pocket expenses for seniors in that donut hole by 100%, and that's very significant to many of our seniors. I just lost my dad, who was a World War II veteran last year. He was 90 years old, and because of some of his health conditions, he had to pay quite a bit of out-of-pocket expenses when he got into that Part D donut hole. So I think that will be a real plus to seniors. I think ultimately the most important thing in this bill will be to seniors. If by by squeezing out inefficiencies in Medicare, if by trying to spend more time to review potential waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare program, we can protect the long-term integrity of Medicare. And by reducing the very quickly increasing cost in health care, not just for seniors on Medicare, but families of all ages, we actually save cost to the Medicare program. If we can reduce the cost of care in our hospitals and in our doctor's office, reduce costs for drugs, then we actually extend the solvency of the Medicare program. And that is of great significance to seniors. So I do think there's some very good provisions in this bill for seniors. One of the questions that I have about the bill, and one of the things I want to review very carefully, because we do have a lot of seniors in our district that depend on Medicare, I want to see that some of the efficiencies listed in Medicare are actually, in the real world, bringing in more efficiencies, bringing out inefficiencies, and that these aren't actually efforts that would in any way reduce services of health care to our seniors. So I will continue to look at that very carefully. But there are some very positive provisions in this bill for seniors, and I just can't emphasize enough how important it is for seniors and all of us to spread the message that let's not accept these things like the mythical death panels. That's just wrong for people to try to scare folks as they push their point of view on this debate. Patricia, thank you. Thank you for participating in our town hall meeting tonight.
Let me tell you that I appreciate you, and don't you and the president ever get discouraged. You're in my prayers. Thank you.
Patricia, thank you, and thank you for your prayers. Bye now.
Thank you.
Okay, the next caller is Barbara from Granbury, and she has a question about the public option. Barbara, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Hi, Barbara. How are you this evening?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for participating tonight.
Well, I'm a recipient of Medicare and very, very grateful. So I know that government involvement in health care works. It works beautifully. And I want to have that option available to so many people that I know personally that can't afford insurance and that don't have insurance. And that have been put in extreme difficulty because of their own personal copays and the extra costs that insurance companies didn't pay. And their premiums are just out of sight. My son-in-law has his own business. My son works for a small business, and I just really encourage you to keep these options open. And thanks for all you're doing. I just appreciate how hard your job is.
Barbara, thank you very much. And obviously this health care issue is a challenging one. There are no simple answers to the issues of trying to hold down cost and provide accessibility to some of the 46 million people in our country who do not have health care insurance today. And I will say that I believe we have the finest quality healthcare system in America, and any bill that I would vote for would have to be assured that it would continue the high quality of healthcare that we have today. And in terms of trying to address some of the problems that do exist under the present situation, there are people who I think now are paying exorbitant insurance rates because they or their child or their spouse has a pre-existing health condition. This bill would not allow insurance companies to punish small businesses or individuals or families simply because they have a pre-existing health condition. I'm hopeful that the insurance exchange that we set up in this bill would actually bring in a lot of competition and allow individuals and small businesses to get the kind of better rates for health insurance that many of our huge corporations are getting today. If you own or run a small business, you know you can't get nearly as low of monthly premiums as a large corporation can. If you're a farmer or a rancher or a self-employed person, the rates you pay are far higher than those of people who are associated with large corporations. Now, I'm hopeful that the insurance exchange will allow the kind of competition that will really bring down costs significantly for small businesses and individuals. For those that don't have health insurance, and let me say that there are 140,000 people in our congressional district, in our 12 counties, that do not have health insurance. The vast majority of those people, I believe, are working. They're working hard to support their families, but in many cases, their companies have dropped health insurance because of the increasing cost. And the fact that so many people in our district and country do not have any health insurance at all really hurts everyone else in the healthcare system that is paying for insurance. In fact, there is what I call a hidden tax, the uninsured tax of $1,800, that every Texan paying health insurance is paying not for their own health care, but to cover part of the cost of others who simply don't have any health insurance. So if through legislation in Congress we can do a better job of reducing the number of people in this country that don't have any health insurance at all, I think we actually reduce the health care cost and insurance premiums of those who presently have insurance, like their insurance, and like the doctors that they have. And finally on that point, if we can provide health insurance for most Americans through a combination of employer participation, personal responsibility, and families taking responsibility for themselves, then I think what we're going to do is take a lot of people out of the emergency rooms of our hospitals, where care can be 10 times more expensive than going to a family physician. If we can reduce the number of people going in our emergency rooms, there's a potential to save billions of dollars in health care costs. And what that means is lower health care costs for individuals, for families, and businesses. And Barbara, thank you. Thank you for participating in our town hall meeting.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to remind everybody again at this time, if you have a question for the congressman, please press *3 on your telephone, *3. Chet, the next question is from Jerry in Hubbard. He has a question about how we're going to pay for the cost of health care reform. Jerry, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Jerry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. Thanks for being part of our town hall.
Well, thank you for coming to our chamber banquet at Hubbard.
You bet. I enjoyed that very much and learned a lot about the water challenges of Central Texas at that town at that chamber banquet.
Very, very extended, too.
You bet.
I want to ask you about the president's guaranteed or said that there'd be no tax increase for the middle-class Americans, and I was just wondering if that's really true. How in the world are we going to pay for this $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion or $2 trillion, whatever it's going to be, to provide finances for this national health care?
Jerry, thanks for asking that question, and I care deeply about that. I was part of the bipartisan effort that led to 4 years of federal surpluses where we were paying down the national debt in the late 1990s and early part of this decade, and I strenuously objected when House leadership back in 2001 got rid of the pay-as-you-go rules that had helped us balance the federal budget and actually bring in, for the first time in many decades, 4 years of surpluses. In this bill, we go back to the pay-as-you-go provisions of the old law, where, according to the Congressional Budget Office, this bill, over a 10-year period, would not increase the deficit. In fact, in the Congressional Budget Office is a nonpartisan operation of the Congress, Jerry, and so it is an objective group of people trying to honestly analyze these bills. Now, let me tell you that before I'm completely comfortable feeling that this bill is completely paid for, I want to carefully evaluate the bill. I want to talk to the CBO officials because I think it is vital that we not increase the national debt significantly through health care reform or other measures. In this particular bill, as written in the House, and let me re-emphasize to everyone participating that I have not made a decision on how to vote on this bill, and I am going to look at all sides of it, review it carefully, and I won't make a commitment on how to vote for it, yes or no, until I have read the bill from cover to cover, have analyzed it carefully, and have had a chance to listen to everyday citizens and doctors and nurses and hospital administrators and small business owners throughout our district. In terms of, Jerry, how this bill is paid for, it is estimated to cost about $100 billion a year. That is obviously a significant cost. It would be about a 3% increase in federal funding. The half of the cost of the bill would be paid for by savings in making our present health care system more efficient. Savings that would come from bringing millions of Americans out of emergency rooms where they don't need to be and putting them into the offices of primary care physicians where it might be, you know, 2 to 10 times cheaper to treat their health care issues there. Savings such as the drug companies and pharmaceutical industry having agreed to reduce about $110 billion of cost for families and seniors if this legislation is passed into law, and saving such as $156 billion over 10 years that would come from reducing the taxpayer subsidy of $1,200 extra per person that is involved in the Medicare Advantage program versus the traditional Medicare program. The other half of the bill would be paid for, Jerry, by a health care tax surcharge on those making over $350,000 a year. And just to let people know what these amounts would be, if somebody made on average $350,000 a year for their family, they wouldn't pay an additional dollar in health care tax surcharge under this House plan. If they make $400,000 a year of net income, then they would be paying an additional $500 a year. If they make $500,000 a year, they would pay $1,500 of additional taxes. If they made $1 million a year, and I don't think there are too many folks like that in our district, but if they made $1 million a year, they would be paying about $9,000 in additional taxes. So there are no taxes proposed in the House bill for people making under, families making under $350,000 a year. Now, Jerry, I'm not a soak-the-rich kind of guy, and I don't know if this particular tax proposal will end up being in the final bill or not. There's some discussions in the Senate to look at other ways to raise the revenues to pay for the half of the cost of this bill that are not covered by cost savings and new efficiencies in our health care system. But I cannot emphasize enough to you that even a bill that has other good things in it, if I'm not convinced that it's fiscally responsible, then I just simply will not support it, because I think it's vital that while we have very large deficits during time of recession, and that always is the case, the fact is that once this recession, national recession, is over, we have got to get back on a glide path toward where I was so proud we were just a few years ago, and that was having balanced budgets. And I think even taking the pain down our huge national debt would be very good for our country's future and the future of our children and our grandchildren. So thank you for raising that, Jerry. As I've had 19 meetings in our district over the last 3 days, I have had a lot of people ask that question, and it shows to me that the people of our district want to see Congress put back in place some of the more pay-as-you-go, fiscally responsible approaches that we had that had worked so well in the 1990s and early part of this decade. So, Jerry, thank you for the question you raise and the and the comments you make by asking that question.
Well, thank you for giving me the time, and thank you for reading the bill.
Well, thank you. And I haven't finished yet. It's over 1,000 pages, but I don't make a lot of commitments, but I will commit to you and others in our district that until I've read every page of that bill, and not only done that, but really analyzed it very carefully, I'm not going to make a commitment to, on how I would vote on the bill.
Thanks
for Jerry.
Okay, Chet, we have Marguerite, who's calling from Waco, who wants to know if members of Congress will be exempt. Marguerite, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Marguerite. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I'd be happy to address your question.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
I wanted to know, there's been talk that members of Congress would be exempt from the proposed new health care. And I wanted to know why, if it's okay for everybody else, then they should certainly jump on the bandwagon too.
Marguerite, I agree with you completely. And as I understand the bill, it does not exempt members of Congress from the provisions of the bill. And just to let you know, and people have a right to know this, and I get a lot of questions about this, right now members of Congress are eligible for the kind of private insurance that every other federal employee is eligible for, whether that's somebody working in the Waco VA hospital or a civilian working in the Department of Defense in Washington, D.C. My wife, Leanne, and I pay into the private health insurance program of Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I believe that whatever bill we pass ought to apply to members of Congress as well. I just think that is a simple matter of fairness, and I very much appreciate your asking that question.
The next caller is Carl, who's calling from Glen Rose, I believe, and he has a question about benefits for illegal aliens. Carl, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Carl, thank you. This is Chet Edwards. Thanks for participating in our town hall meeting, and I welcome your question.
Okay, I'll tell you that I do appreciate your efforts and the way you go about it. You're quiet, and you go about your work just like you ought to. I really appreciate you. My question is... The bill, I believe, or some of it, says that no benefits will be paid to illegals of any stature in this country. Of course, a lot of them are working, and they do have health care coverage through an employer, but probably a third of them or something. But I don't think that illegals ought to participate in our insurance that way. But in case of it's got to be worded, because in case of a catastrophic automobile wreck, a fall or something where that, you know, they're just really crushed up and beat up, humanitarian reasons, they could not turn them back. Is that correct? I mean, they would get some sort of treatment regardless of who pays for it.
Carl, that's a very good question, and I'm asked an awful lot about the impact of illegal immigrants on the healthcare system and whether this bill would provide healthcare benefits to those immigrants. Let me just say that this bill specifically and clearly says that the benefits of this bill do not apply to illegal aliens. So there is no new benefit added to those who are illegally in this country as a result of the proposed House legislation. Now, let me say two other things. One, we are the kind of society that if a 11-year-old child whose parents came into this country when that child was born in Mexico and at the age of 3 came to this country, when that child is a little bit older, if he or she is in a life or death situation and they walk into an emergency room, of our hospitals. Americans are the kind of people, we're not going to say to that child that, no, we're not going to provide you care. We're just not like that. And doctors I've met with in the last few days, even those who have great concerns about the number of illegal immigrants in the United States, have said, you know, we've taken the Hippocratic Oath, so we're going to provide care if someone is really in a serious situation, and particularly if they're in a life-threatening situation. I think what we really need to do, separate from this health care plan, is pass new legislation to really do a better job of protecting our borders in the United States, setting up a system where employers have a data bank where they can find out whether a potential job applicant is here legally or illegally. And then once we have that system in place, and we have the technology to be able to do that, Carl, then I think we have to enforce the law and tell employers you're going to be held accountable if you knowingly hire illegal immigrants to work for you. We also have been working very hard to increase, and we've doubled or tripled the number of Border Patrol agents on most parts of the southern United States border in the last several years. We built a fence in many parts of the Texas and U.S.-Mexican border. And as a result, and possibly as a result of the economic slowdown in our country, the number of illegal immigrants coming into the United States has dropped dramatically. But we must have better laws on the books. We ought to enforce those laws and then have a rational system that says how many immigrants do we want to accept into our country a year, whether they're PhDs that help us run our high-tech companies or whether they're people who help pick grapes in California, and then allow that number of immigrants to come into the United States legally. If we can do that, do a better job on that front and of enforcing our immigration laws, then I think we can reduce the some of the and many of the costs that are added to the healthcare system as a result of the number of illegal aliens here in the United States. And I am not one to ever disparage those who would cross a border in order to try to feed their families. If my two young sons, JT and Garrison, were crying tonight when they went to bed because I couldn't get a job and feed them, there's no river wide enough or deep enough I wouldn't cross to get a job to provide for them. So these are, by and large, good people. There are some exceptions, but by and large, they're good people wanting to support their families. But the United States has a right to protect, particularly in an era of terrorism, a right to protect our borders, and we need effective immigration laws. And if we do that, that will be another way we can bring down some of the added cost on our health care system. Let me, if I could, take a few minutes out to, now that we've had a chance to contact people in all 12 counties, if I could take a few minutes out to just give you a few insights into where the health care reform legislation is in Washington. I know there are a lot of questions and confusion about that. Also give you some thoughts about my approach on the legislation, and then summarize what I consider to be five of the key basic points of the House health care legislation. Just to begin with, in the 19 health care meetings I've had this week in our district with doctors and nurses, hospital administrators, small business owners, and everyday citizens, I know there is an awful lot of frustration about the complexity and the length of the 1,000-page House bill, and I share that frustration with each of you. The truth is it requires an awful lot of effort for any of us to try to figure out exactly what is and is not in the House bill. That is exactly why I told the House leadership at the end of July that I would vote no on any bill that was brought up before I had time to carefully review and read the bill and to hear from my constituents, like at this town hall meeting tonight. And the reason there was not a House vote on health care reform before the August congressional recess is because I and other House members felt that health care reform was just too important an issue to rush through the House. And frankly, I felt very strongly about that. In the House, health care reform bill has been reported out of three different committees, and a vote on the House floor is expected sometime in September or possibly October. In the Senate, no bill has been reported out of any committee, but serious discussions are ongoing. And I do, as I referenced earlier, applaud the Senate for trying to develop a bipartisan health care reform bill. I don't know if they will be successful in doing so, but if an effective bipartisan bill could be developed, that would be far better than having a bill pass on a purely partisan basis. I do believe there's been far too much partisanship on both sides of the aisle and among special interest groups, a lot of gamesmanship in this process. And that is one reason I think there's so much confusion about what is and is not in the House bill. And I'll make two commitments to each of you participating in this town hall meeting and to our district. First, I will not make a decision to vote yes or no on a health care reform bill until I've read the bill from beginning to end, have reviewed it carefully, and have listened carefully to constituents from all walks of life throughout our district. Second, I believe health care reform is one of the most important issues I will ever vote on in Congress. It affects, as you know, virtually every family and every business in our district and country. And for that reason, I'm going to vote based on what I believe is the right thing to do, based on constituent input and a careful analysis of the bill. I will not allow any Democrat, whether it is the President or the House Speaker, to tell me how to vote. On the recent cap and trade energy bill, I believe my no vote showed my willingness to go against Democratic leaders when I think their legislation is flawed. At the same time, on health care, I will not let anyone pressure me to vote no by threatening to defeat me in any future election. The bottom line is that doing what is right on health care is far more important to me than partisan loyalty or political elections. Let me share with you now a few of my basic views on health care reform that will drive whether I vote yes or no on the final legislation. I have made the decision to oppose any legislation that I believe would lead to a Canadian-style socialized health care system. That type of one-size-fits-all health care would not work in America, and I believe could seriously jeopardize the quality of our present U.S. health care system. I still have a lot of questions about the pending House bill before I decide how to vote on it. It will be very important to me that any bill I would support would have to do several things. First, allow citizens to continue, if they want to do so, their present private insurance company's coverage and their present choice of doctors. Second, it must maintain the quality of our present public-private partnership in health care. Third, it must effectively reduce cost increases for health insurance and health care that are really, as so many of you know, putting a real burden on families and small businesses. And fourth, any bill I support must be paid for and not increase federal deficits. And finally, before we go back to continued questions and answers, let me quickly summarize for you, since there's been so much confusion and so many questions to me about what's actually in the bill. Let me give you what I consider to be five of the key principles in the House bill. The first key principle of the bill would be health insurance reform. And number one, it would say that insurance companies cannot deny coverage for someone because they have a pre-existing health care condition. Second, if a person has a pre-existing health condition, insurance will not be able to charge them exorbitant rates, as often happens today. Third, if someone loses his or her job, they will be able to continue their present coverage at an affordable rate through an insurance exchange, which is a competitive marketplace of insurance policies and companies. Fourth, the insurance exchange will allow small businesses and individuals to buy insurance at much more competitive rates, similar to those offered to large corporations. And fifth, insurance companies will no longer be able to penalize a small company by dramatically raising their premiums because one or two of their employees had a serious illness or accident. In fact, I was talking to one of our small business owners in our district earlier this week, and they told me that because one employee had a serious health care issue, the insurance company came to them and said they were going to have to raise their premiums by 18%. that small business owner is now trying to decide whether to charge higher insurance rates for all of their employees or drop health insurance for every employee in the company simply because one person, through no fault of the business, had a serious health care issue. I think it's critical that we end that kind of discrimination against small businesses when it comes to pre-existing health care conditions and those businesses that have maybe one employee or two employees that have a real problem. And finally, on insurance reform, annual and lifetime caps for insurance health care coverage will be prohibited. I ran into a teacher earlier this week up in the northern part of our district whose child has a brain tumor, and as a result of that, he and his wife, both of whom are working, are facing their lifetime insurance cap, and as a result, he is thinking about quitting his job so he can cash out his retirement savings in order to continue the health care so desperately needed by his young daughter. I think it's just essential that we have health insurance reform that sees that a family doesn't have to choose between their hard-earned job and their life savings and retirement savings and providing decent health care for their daughter that has a brain tumor. The second key principle in the House bill is personal responsibility. It is proposed in the bill all individuals will be required to purchase insurance, much like people must presently have auto insurance in order to drive a car. Tax credits will be offered to reduce premiums for low- and middle-income families. The third principle in the House bill is employer responsibility. All businesses will be required to provide health insurance for their employees. Now, small businesses under $500,000 in annual payroll will be exempted, and businesses with 25 or less employees will receive subsidies of up to 50% of the cost of their employees' insurance premiums. The fourth principle, and this is key, is cost containment in the bill. If we do nothing, it is estimated that Texas families in the year 2016, which isn't that far away, will be paying $24,000 a year for their health insurance and health insurance premiums. That represents over 51% of the 51% of the average income of Texas families. Cost reduction provisions in this bill would include things such as getting people out of expensive emergency room care and into family physicians' offices, encouraging preventive care measures such as mammographies and colonoscopies, reducing the $1,800 a year hidden tax that insured individuals must pay to cover the health care costs of those without insurance, includes drug companies' concessions to drop for seniors 50% of the cost of buying drugs in the donut hole of Medicare Part D. The bill will also include cost reductions that result from much more oversight of Medicare to try to eliminate wherever possible waste, fraud, and abuse. And all of the insurance reforms I previously mentioned would help reduce the cost of health care. And then the fifth and final principle of the bill is we talked about with Jerry and his call from Hubbard would be that the bill has to be paid for. And as many of you may have heard me say earlier, some of you got on since that question was asked, approximately half the cost of the House bill would be paid for by the cost savings reeking out or squeezing out inefficiencies in the present health care system and trying to get concessions from drug companies, hospitals, and other health care entities. The other half of this bill would be paid for by health tax surcharge on those people making over $350,000 a year. And to repeat, if you make $400,000 a year of adjusted gross income, you'd pay $500 more in taxes in this bill. If you make $500,000 a year, you'd pay $1,500 more. And if you make $1 million a year, I don't know how many people in our district make that much, but if you did, you'd pay $9,000 more. And the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has concluded on July 17th of this year that the House bill would actually create a $7 billion surplus over 10 years. Let me add a footnote to that I'm not just going to accept that analysis because I think making this bill deficit neutral and fiscally responsible would be a vital provision before I would vote for it, and I'm going to examine that CBO analysis very carefully. So that's my effort to try to give you a summary of where the process is in Congress on health care reform and some of the major key provisions, since so many people have asked about those in the many, many meetings I've been having recently. And with that, let's get back to your questions and comments.